wish I was like some genius who knew that like playing with perspective was going to really resonate with people, but it literally just came down to the fact that like I didn't have money for a studio. I'm going to build it outside. And then I was like, oh, what if people knew I shot outside? Wouldn't that be kind of funny? So I did like one shot that was a little wider and one that was closer, but I had no idea that I was like coming up with something that people would resonate or that I would like.
Hey there, I'm Katina, one of the co-founders of Daydreamers, and you're listening to the Unproductive Podcast, a weekly chat where we pick the brains of creatives, entrepreneurs, thinkers, and tinkerers, all of whom have approached life differently. Together, we're redefining how we spend our free time in a world that's hyper-focused on efficiency at the expense of, well, everything else. We'll dig into the habits, mindsets, and experiences of some of the most creative minds in our world today so we can all spend a little less time scrolling and a little more time dreaming. Let's get started. Hey everyone, and welcome back to the Unproductive Podcast. We're back for episode 10, and we know the past few weeks have been crazy in our world, but we're excited to be here with our calming meditative voices, as we've heard many times, to hopefully be a source of inspiration and calm in all of the chaos.
I hope you guys are listening to this stuff and not falling asleep to it.
Yeah, we've heard from our guests and listeners alike that our voices are very calming. So we take that as a compliment.
Yeah. All right. Before we dive in, things have been crazy at Daydreamers as well.
In a good way.
Yeah, a lot of long nights, but a lot of big, exciting news to share with you guys. Our mission has always been to help the world feel more alive and make creativity more accessible. The world has kind of really shifted based off when Katina and I had this first idea about Daydreamers. And over the past few weeks, we really put our ear to the ground and heard your feedback. So we're bringing creativity straight to your home. We're launching our first beta product next week. Yeah, it's exciting stuff for us. So make sure you're part of our email crew. We're going to let all of the email subscribers know what's coming up. Get first dibs on this limited release product. So sign up at Daydreamer Space to stay in the know. And we can't wait to continue to develop this community with you guys. So thank you for all your support. And we'll dive into the regularly scheduled programming.
Yeah, we're overflowing with excitement about this. We have really heard so much of what you guys want and are craving. So we're trying to share that with you as quickly as possible. And one of those things is this conversation with Justin. So this week, we're going to be talking to Justin Bettman, who is the prolific but still punk rock, in his words, photographer who's worked with everyone from Daniel Radcliffe to New York City's Times Square Arts Alliance, which is crazy. It's the organization that runs everything from the big billboards in Times Square to major art installations. So Justin's been around the block a couple times. But when you go back to where he started, Justin's love of photography really launched way back in high school when he was just looking for ways to get into his favorite concerts. So like any entrepreneurial kid, he would just do a photo shoot with the band to get free entry and listen to their music. And he saw it as a passion project for a really long time. But it wasn't until he had this light bulb moment in college after shooting what soon became an album cover for Lil Romeo in a dorm room.
You guys remember him?
Yeah. So cool. It was then when he realized that it was actually possible to take his love for art and photography and turn it into a sustainable and fulfilling job.
But it wasn't that simple. You know, it's never a straight line from A to B, and neither was it for Justin and a lot of the people on the podcast. As you'll hear in our chat, Justin continued living by his motto, do first, ask questions later. Whether it was his first job at Ogilvy, it's a top-tier advertising agency in New York City, where he had joined a rotational program, but somehow figured out to be how to become the in-house photographer.
So crazy.
And then continuing on with this motto, he decided to create Set in the Street, which is now a viral and international art project that simply started as a way for him to have fun with photography without having access to many fancy sets, props, or even sort of permits, you know, and we'll hear about that.
Yeah. I think this conversation is so liberating and it's so cool for all of us right now, and especially anyone who feels like they have this creative spark within them, but is too constrained by what they should be doing or what's normal in society. Kind of like what El Luna talked about in an earlier episode.
Yep.
But for those of you who are tuning in because you're obsessed with photography, Justin not only shares the exact ways that he prepares and thinks about a photo shoot with really famous people, but for the rest of us who just take pictures with our iPhones, he also dives deep into something extremely important: the mindset that he's cultivated to help him get from there to here without letting money, resources, or excuses hold him back.
Seems pretty punk rock to me, honestly. Yeah.
So cool.
And before we dive in, we want to give a quick shout out to eBay Girl 2015 for her review titled "New Fave Podcast." Such a breath of fresh air. Love listening to Katina and Doopy and have a chat with super intriguing people. Where a lot of other podcasts are obviously another stop on a press tour and a way for people to plug their latest project, here they're stopping by to just have a genuine conversation, no motive, and allowing us to all to listen in. Great guest lineup so far, and I can't wait to see who they bring up next.
Cool.
Yeah, that sounds amazing. For us, it feels the same way too, getting to talk to people, go to their houses, or meeting them up for these interviews, and then bringing everyone along for the ride.
Yeah, exactly. And I think also just being a fly on the wall to these people's journeys is so inspiring for us and hopefully for you guys. So let's keep being punk rock about it.
We'll carry all our audio equipment with us. Don't worry. Yeah. We're making these podcast episodes happen.
Yeah, exactly.
And a quick reminder, don't forget to rate and review the Unproductive Podcast on Apple Podcasts. This simply helps more people find the podcast and live a more creative and conscious life.
Let's get started. Justin, thank you so much for being here today or having us in your home. We're so excited to be here and kind of dig into your path. We have a lot of things to cover. So before we kind of get into where you are today, we love taking our audience back to the childhood of whoever we're connecting with and really diving into like what you liked to do as a kid and kind of who you were as a child and what you did for fun. So tell us a little bit about that.
Sure. So I grew up in the Northern California Bay Area, right near Stanford University. I had an older sister, like upper middle class. I was pretty into playing hockey as like a kid. That was like my sport. I definitely liked making people laugh and being the center of attention. Yeah, I'd say hockey was like the main thing I enjoyed doing as a kid.
Cool. And I guess when you were younger, did you ever consider yourself creative? Like what were your things you liked to do outside of school?
So I had one friend, this guy, David Holland, and he was an amazing illustrator. His mom was like one of the first people, I think, at Adobe. And so I would always go over to his house and we would like play with, she would get this Play-Doh. I forget what it was called. Magic something. I don't know. Or we would illustrate or whatever. And I was Jewish and we also went to Hebrew school together. So I spent a lot of time at his house, and part of me enjoyed doing all these things, but he was always 10 times better at me than it. So it was one of those like things where it exposed me to the creative world, but also I felt like I wasn't very good at it. So that was like some of my first exposure into something somewhat creative. I also really liked playing with Kinects. I wasn't a Lego kid, but
yeah,
big on the Kinects. I remember for Hanukkah when I was like 8 or 9 years old, I got this roller coaster that was like 6 feet long, 3 feet tall.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And I think I built it within like 24 hours of
getting it. Oh my gosh.
Is this the one where you can put like electronic motors and that thing moves? I had the same thing. I used that too. Not a Lego fan.
Yeah. So I remember being super psyched on that and taking over my family's living room. But I think within school, I had definitely excelled more in like the technical side. I was more of a math guy than reading.
Interesting.
Yeah.
So tell us a little bit then about the first time you picked up a camera. Did that happen when you were a kid or when you were in high school? Like, what was that like?
I don't have a definitive moment of like the first time I picked up a camera. I remember when I was like, maybe I was 12 and my neighbor across the street was 14. He had a flip phone that had a camera in it. And I think it was like 1 megapixel, like Sprint flip phone.
Totally.
And I remember thinking that was pretty sweet. And my dad like was into photography when he was in high school and college. And after that, him and his brother had like a mini photography business. My dad ended up becoming an electrical engineer. But I remember he got a digital SLR when I was in high school, and I had a t-shirt clothing company. So I wasn't good at illustrating, but I was very into the music scene and going to concerts. And so I wanted to have some reason to be there. So I started a clothing company, and the bands would wear the clothes that I had, and I would sell the t-shirts out of my backpack in high school.
Cool. Oh, wow.
And so I had to take pictures of the bands wearing the clothing. So that was kind of my first like entry into photography. And I think the story of how I got my first camera was funny. I was at like a youth group retreat. And after each person got elected, we would like take pictures of whoever it was. So I borrowed the guy's camera. I was taking a picture and I gave it back to him, and he didn't have the camera and it fell flat on its face. And I like broke the lens. It was like a $350 point and shoot.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh, can I pay to get it repaired? And he's like, I don't want like a fixed broken camera. Like, just give me the money for a new one. You can get that one fixed and that's your camera. So that was my first like camera. And then I remember taking pictures for like MySpace or whatever with my friends. And then that was just with a point and shoot. And then the DSLR was kind of my first like entry into like actually shooting. And that was with a lot of the bands and stuff that were wearing the clothing.
Everyone started getting the point and shoot, but there's only a very select few people that make the transition over to the DSLR. Like, what was the interest? Was it always like a means to an end, sort of like, I need better quality pictures so I can sell more merch? Or was it something that like lit a spark, you know, in your heart or your mind, and you were like, this is something I want to actually get better at?
I think in high school I had a bit of an identity crisis. I played water polo, but I was definitely not like a jock. Mm-hmm. And so I think the camera slowly became my like ticket into being a creative person, or in the artsy scene, even though I couldn't do music or like the type of art that a lot of the people around me were doing. And also I like going to shows. So it also became my ticket into concerts. I would find bands in the parking lot and say, hey, if I shoot your show, will you put me on the guest list?
Mm-hmm.
And then kind of led to, hey, do you guys want to do some photos outside of the venue before the live concert? And that's just kind of how I started taking pictures of music.
Yeah, I love that. I feel like something that just sparks for me is kind of how you got the confidence to be able to ask those questions. Because I feel like going back to one of the things you said was maybe this like inherent competitiveness to like be good at something, but starting a new passion or hobby, you're not necessarily the best when you first start. So what was that like in your mind? Did you think about that at all?
I didn't really think about the competition because I didn't know too many other people who were shooting music.
Yeah.
And the people I did know who were doing it weren't like incredible by any means. So I wasn't really scared in that sense. And then also people were like guest listing me, so it didn't cost them anything.
Right.
So the stakes were pretty low at that point. But I remember once I started asking bands to do like promo shoots before their shows or when they were in town the day before, that I felt the pressure of like, okay, I need to deliver because they have limited time off. Usually when you're in a band and you're touring, you spend the whole day driving, you get to the venue, you play a show, you sleep, and then you do it again.
Yeah.
So any free time is valuable. So that's kind of where I first started feeling like the stakes were getting a little bit higher.
I like that as a concept, like starting with the stakes low in any way, but also like getting the experience as you go and kind of rising it as you get to connect with more people. So I guess take us through your process of like, you were in high school and started doing this. Then you got to college, like, did you ever think of this as a career, or you just, I know before we started recording, you were talking about working at a bank over a summer. So I guess not potentially.
Yeah. Initially I thought, like, if you wanted to do music, or sorry, if you wanted to do photography, you could tour with a band and make, you know, $500 a week maybe. Or you could shoot weddings and bar mitzvahs. Mm-hmm. And then I went to college. I was shooting a lot throughout college, but I thought I was going to go into finance. I interned at a bank after my freshman year. And I studied business. I tried to take a photo class at the school and they wanted me to take the very beginner one. I was like, well, I already do stuff. They're like, no, you're not conceptual enough. You need to start at the beginning. And I was like, all right, cool. I'll see you guys later.
Yeah.
I don't need to take a class. I already own my own camera and a couple lights. Right. But I guess to tie back to the initial question of, like, how did that transition happen where I noticed that it was a possibility. So I did a shoot with Little Romeo, who went to USC when I was in college.
That's
like,
awesome.
Yeah. Initially it was like a shoot, like literally in a dorm conference or like study room.
Oh my gosh.
And then, he invited me to like come to the studio with him or whatever. So I did a shoot in the studio. And then he used the photo for an album cover without paying me.
Oh, wow.
And so I hit up like the only music photographer I knew who was like big league or whatever. Yeah. I was like, hey, like, what should I do? And she's like, well, you could try to sue him or whatever. But like, he's not selling so many copies of this anyways. And like, it's probably not worth your time. But like, if you do want to make a living off of photography, like, music's a tough way to go. You should try shooting advertising. Mm. And I was like, what do you mean? And she's like, you know, when you see that Coke billboard on the side of the freeway, like, someone got paid $40,000 to take a picture of someone drinking that Coke out of the glass bottle. And I was like, sick, that's where I need to be. It's a lot better than $300 for a promo shoot. So that kind of first opened my eyes into, okay, photography could be a viable career. Mm-hmm. My parents definitely weren't fully sold on the fact that you could just easily make 40 grand shooting someone drinking a bottle of soda.
And Justin took that realization seriously. He's now a hugely sought-after artist who's went on to work with major brands like Spotify and Nike. But we know that his path wasn't a simple straight line. Oftentimes, we hear that taking a creative life path isn't necessarily logical. It's difficult to break into. It doesn't pay. We imagine starving artists or prodigies who just never quite make it. But Justin didn't let those long-held societal beliefs deter him. He applied his logical, and might we say investment banking mindset, and mitigated the risks that he could. Let's hear exactly how he did that, and most importantly, convinced his parents that he could continue tapping into his creativity as a career.
That was kind of what first opened my eyes. And then I got interested in trying to shoot ads. So I started shooting fake ads in college. Mm-hmm. And then met someone at an alumni networking event who worked at an ad agency and asked him, hey, can I go in and show my portfolio to the art buyer, which is the person at the ad agency who looks for talent for photography and for specific campaigns will be like, okay, this is the right photographer, and present them to the art directors and creative directors. So that was kind of my first entry into understanding the like world of advertising photography.
So interesting. Before we kind of dive into that, I mean, I think Doopy and I, and this will resonate to a lot of our listeners, but we've experienced this too, when your parents don't necessarily like believe that a creative endeavor or career path is something that's viable, especially from a financial perspective. So was that something that your parents were like, all right, go for it? Or did you have to do convincing? Like, tell us a little bit about that.
So in college, I was getting paid like, I don't know, between $300 and $1,500, maybe $2,000 for shoots. Like, I did a music video over a weekend. That one I got $2,000. And then it would be a quicker shoot and make $300. But for a college student, that's pretty good.
Yeah.
And if I was doing three shoots at $350 a week, that was $1,000.
Yeah.
That's $50,000 a year.
That's pretty
Which
great.
As a college student is pretty good. But it was hard to keep it so consistent. And the clients I was going after, a lot of them were like students or friends of friends. And so the budgets were fairly small. So in order to keep up that consistency, the the lake dries out at some point.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And so initially I started interning at an ad agency, and then I was debating leaving college. I was like, all right, do I want to work or as an assistant in the photography industry, or do I want to work at this ad agency? And I was like, well, I'll apply only to this ad agency. And if I don't get that, then I'll work as a photo assistant and stay in LA. And I ended up getting the job. It was for Ogilvy and Mather, and then moved to New York and did a rotational program with them. And so the rotational program was through the different sides of the business, so not the creative department. And so I did that. I worked my first 3 months doing strategy for Kimberly Clark Femcare products.
Yeah. Oh
my gosh. So it was pretty cool going to bars and being like, yep, I know all about Kotex and Depend. And then after that, I did like account management for IKEA. And then I got lucky and landed a role in the like art buying department. So I could kind of see what went on behind the scenes before photographers are hired. And then while I was in that department, I was on a shoot and met the chief creative officer and showed her like my portfolio of photography and creative on my phone. And she was like, oh, this is great. And I was like, well, can I move into the creative department, which we're not really supposed to go to from that training program.
Yeah.
And she's like, we'll give you a 3 month trial. And if it works out, great. And if not, you'll be looking for a new job.
Yeah.
And then it ended up working out. So I didn't go straight from college doing photography to shooting full time. I worked at the ad agency for like 6 or 7 years.
Oh, wow.
Wow.
At that point, like while you were at the ad agency, even doing the rotational program, was your mind, were you happy and pleased with, you know, if you weren't going the route of like the creative, you know, photography side, would you have been happy with your life outcome there? Or was there always like, this is a step to the right direction for you?
I think it was always a step to the right direction. But it's funny because then when you get to the destination, then the direction keeps moving. Right. So initially it was like, okay, I want to be in the creative department. So after I did that first year rotational program, I got in the creative department. And that was like, okay, I don't want to just be in the creative department. I want to be the one shooting it. So then I was shooting in-house. And then it was like, oh, I don't want to be the one shooting it in-house. I want to be the guy who's getting hired externally to shoot it. And that's where I am now. So it kind of kept moving. But yeah, initially when I did that first year long rotational program, I told my parents like, all right, you want me to do this job? I'll do it for a year and then I'm leaving.
Yeah.
And then I kind of kept realizing that there were going to be more doors that were opened if I stuck around a little bit longer.
So let's talk about that bit. You know, you're at Ogilvy right now. You're actually in the creative department and you're getting to shoot in-house.
Yeah.
I mean, that seems like to many photographers or many people, like you've made it, like this is amazing. You're getting to do what you love. And what was the origin for leaving? You know, how did you come up with that decision? I want to know the moment and like you took the leap of faith.
Yeah. So working in-house was great for a lot of reasons. I was pretty young and I was getting to shoot a lot of big campaigns that normally someone of my age would just not get the experience and the opportunity to do that. So that was awesome. But since I was in-house, they were billing me out at like $10,000 a day. And I got whatever the equivalent of my salary broke down to per day for that. So $400.
Yeah.
And so I felt like while I was learning a lot, at some point, the amount that I was learning versus how much I was being paid wasn't worth it. And I was also freelancing a lot while I was working there. And so it got to the point where I was using up every vacation day I had. And then at some point I negotiated with my boss to, instead of getting a raise, I just wanted to have one day off every single week. And so he was super understanding of my goals and trajectory. So he was cool with that. And then did that for like 6 months or a year. And it was just like a nice gradual jump into shooting full time. And so the goal I made for myself before I left was that I wanted to have a photo agent. So other people on my team who were rooting for me and selling my work, so that I wasn't just jumping out on my own and like totally doing it blind.
Yeah, no, I love that. I think oftentimes folks think that you have to, like the wanderlust sort of feeling that you have to quit your job and, you know, just go for it. But it seems throughout, like even from your first time picking up a camera to actually going out and doing this for yourself, it was like a logical process and you gave yourself time to sort of get one milestone and then reach the next milestone so that, you know, you're able to be successful.
Yeah. I mean, I think I'm someone who likes to be comfortable and I think generally I am risk adverse and I've two close friends of mine who are both like entrepreneurs, and one of them, his company was valued at $1 billion and then totally went to shit, and now he's doing his next one and it's also doing really great. But he always makes fun of me of like, the running joke was like, when are you actually gonna leave Ogilvy? And he's like, you're never gonna actually leave. And now that I finally left, it's just kind of a running joke. But for me, it was always like, I want to make sure I have everything in place, because there were other people who worked at Ogilvy who were also in-house, who left well before me and who were younger than me. And I think it's been a lot tougher of a process of them making it in the freelance world versus I was taking meetings and doing a lot of freelance work while I was still working there. So I wasn't starting from the ground up. I already had a good foundation.
Yeah. Could you tell us a little bit about that? And also, I mean, we'll dive into some of your like really cool projects outside of your kind of professional shooting as well. But did Set in the Streets start while you were still working at Ogilvy?
It did. Yeah. So I wanted to shoot these stylized sets, and while I was working at Ogilvy, it was great, but everything, especially the bigger client work, had to be approved by so many different people, and there were big budgets. And so the creative was somewhat limited because it had to go through so many layers. And I totally get that. But I had certain desires to do work on my own that felt a little bit more creative, and I was the boss of it.
Totally.
And so I wanted to shoot these stylized sets, and I didn't have money to pay for a big studio like you would do when you're normally shooting these stylized sets. So I decided, hey, what if I just taped up a background against the side of a wall, rolled out some carpet and threw down a couple couches or whatever it might be for the stylized scene. And then I realized, well, if I'm going to build it on the street, what's another way I could save money? Well, instead of having to rent a couch or buy one, what if I just find one? I was living in a loft building where people were moving in and out every single week. And there was always just a ton of furniture that my apartment that I was living in at the time was mostly furnished from stuff I had found. I was like, what if I build these sets from stuff that I find?
Yeah.
And so that's kind of how the idea started. And then while I was shooting the first one, people kept asking, hey, can I take a picture in there? Can I take a picture in there? And there was only like 20 minutes with the perfect light. So I was like, sorry, not right now. But then it like a light bulb went off in my head of, well, what if I left these sets up for other people to interact with and take their own photos in? And initially I was a little scared of getting a fine for littering or whatnot. But I was like, if I do, that's more punk rock and super cool. So who cares? And this is Bushwick. And if a cop tells me that, I'll tell him, well, I found this trash on the side of the street. I just, you know, put it all together.
I'm still living on this side of the street.
Exactly. Yeah. I curated it all. And then, so the second set that I did, I left it up and I had a hashtag, take a photo, hashtag set in the street. And that one like blew up immediately. The Brooklyn News 11 or whatever, like reached out. And I was just like, not ready for people to be so into it. It was like before the Museum of Ice Cream and these like photo booth installations. And it was kind of more the like punk rock version of it, I guess, where it was like very DIY and rough. And it was literally found furniture. But it seemed to resonate with people, this idea of like, you know, what happens if you only see the smaller piece of a larger picture, and the idea of like leaving it up to other people to have their own photos taken in.
Tell us a little bit about like it as a moment in time, because I feel like when it first started, social media was so different than it is today. And as you mentioned, these spaces where people could go and kind of take pictures for themselves didn't really exist. So tell us about like the cultural movement maybe that was taking place during that time.
Yeah, I mean, I think now actually maybe less of my friends use Instagram and are scrolling all the time. I feel like stories is more popular now than actual Instagram posts. But yeah, at the time, Instagram posts were really popular. And I think the idea that people would just stumble upon this and it wasn't a super curated experience left it up to people's imagination. And it was almost like, what is this? And then people would figure it out on their own. And I think giving people the ability to figure it out for themselves versus it being so set up, made it feel like they're less of like a pawn in a scheme or whatever. And they're like choosing to do this, and it made them feel more creative.
Yeah. It's so interesting. Something at Daydreamers that's really important to us is this idea called create, not curate, because so much of our lives is based around like curating these perfect aesthetics. So I feel like the ability to just stumble into something that's almost undiscovered doesn't really exist anymore. So it's really cool to kind of create that out in the world.
Yeah, no, I mean, I couldn't agree more. Even from like the photography sense of, you know, I loved the juxtaposition between like zooming in and zooming out. And that kind of shows that creativity exists everywhere, right? It's the perspective and the lens you take. And oftentimes, even for us, like when, you know, admiring your work, I was like, he probably had permits to get some of this stuff, or how, like, there's so much thought process that needs to go on to do something of this scale. And then, you know, in our research, you just come to find out sometimes you just have to go for it. So can you give us a little bit of advice? Because everyone has a device in their pockets that they can take some amazing sort of, you know, photos with. But what's your advice for someone to actually do it, you know, and actually go for it?
I think being young and naive is helpful to some degree.
Yeah.
Because I think if I were to try to do the same thing now, I'd find a million reasons why it's not the technical proper way to do it. Mm-hmm. But for me, it was like came out of desperation.
A lot of times in life, we get held back from taking action by our own beliefs. As Justin said, as we get older, we usually get weighed down by the proper way to go about something, the rules that we have to follow. But what happens if you let all of that go for a moment? After the break, Justin will share the magic of doing first and asking questions later, and how living by that mindset literally sparked his creative career.
Hey, it's Doopy here. We have a really exciting announcement here at Daydreamers. Next week, we're launching our first beta product and bringing creativity straight to your home. Our big launch is happening on Wednesday, July 8th. Mark your calendars. But those who are part of our email crew get first dibs. There's a limited amount of products, so make sure you're in the know by signing up at daydreamerspace.com. As always, the Unproductive Podcast is brought to you by Daydreamers. At Daydreamers, we know that creativity is in our human DNA, but we don't always have access to it. So we're making it easier for you to get in the flow and cool to have hobbies again. Show us how you're redefining free time by tagging us on Instagram at daydreamerspace. Let's get it.
Before the break, Justin shared the exact mindset that he approached his now viral, internationally renowned creative project Set in the Street with. And guess what? It doesn't take anything fancy. Literally, that's the magic of it. One of our favorite aspects of Justin's story is that throughout his career, whether it was shooting Lil Romeo in his college dorm room or Cal Penn for People magazine's Sexiest Man Alive issue, he's continued to hold on to this punk rock mindset. Do first and ask questions later. We're about to hear how Justin went from shooting with his friends on furniture about to be picked up for the garbage in Brooklyn to traveling the world and continuing to create art that shifts the way we see it. Justin is the ever technical thinker, and he walks us through exactly how he prepares for photo shoots, both big and small, what he looks for when shooting, and how he continues to approach his love for photography with a beginner's mind, something we can all use a little bit more of. Let's tune in.
And when I was crafting the idea, I owned photo lights and I was thinking, hey, do I want to light this? And then I came to the conclusion of no, I want it to be a thing where it's found furniture, at least initially it was. Mm-hmm. Now sometimes it's rented or sourced, but found furniture in available locations with available light. So literally anyone could have taken it,
right,
if they had a phone, mm-hmm, and the idea to do it. So that was kind of my thought process with that. But I think just going for it, and the downside was that the photos wouldn't turn out good and maybe I would get a $250 fine, but like, mm-hmm, there just wasn't much of a downside, and I could have never predicted how much like the upside would have really helped start my career.
Yeah.
I think that project in particular really was like a jumping off point. Cause after I had done like four or five of them, guerrilla style, Times Square Arts Alliance reached out and commissioned me to do one in Times Square, which was super cool.
So, yeah, so cool.
That was up for 5 days. And like thousands of people took photos in that one. So, yeah, I think doing those personal projects in whatever field you're in, allows people to see what you actually enjoy doing, and then they're able to commission you to do work in the style and taste that you enjoy doing on your own.
Yeah. So tell us a little bit about your work now. Like, is it in a similar vein or style? And do you still do types of projects that are guerrilla style, I guess? Or is it a lot more strategic and focused?
I'd say the lighting, or not the lighting, but the set design is still very similar. And like, it's referenced a lot when people reach out to me to bid on jobs. So I think it still is a very good marketing tool and, and things that people gravitate towards. The way that I typically do projects now, if it's for a client, is like much more structured and permitted and done properly. I always like to say that I like to experiment and do things low budget for myself, but when I'm doing it and it has to be perfect, we can't cut those same corners. But I still like to experiment and try new things. I collaborate with this prop house called Acme Brooklyn, and once a month we do these collaborations, where it's like pretty much just me and Sean Patrick Anderson, the owner. Maybe we'll have one assistant, but just experimenting and trying things. And it's funny to see how much that personal work, where the budget's $500 for the whole shoot, maybe $1,000 including lunch and whatnot, ends up leading to work that is much more lucrative. But I think in those situations where it's low stakes and there's not a lot of people there and you're just able to experiment, and the cost of it failing is not a big deal.
Yeah. I love that you kind of still bring that into your work today and kind of use it for inspiration.
Totally.
I want to go back to the question regarding the idea. I think what your photographs resonate with so much with folks is like your perspective and your the concept of storytelling. So can you tell us a little bit like the behind the scenes, what goes through your mind, how you come up with this concept? And
even how you prepare for like shoots today. Like, what do you think about beforehand, or what research might you do beforehand?
Sure. So for Set in the Street, I wish I was like some genius who knew that like playing with perspective was going to really resonate with people, but it literally just came down to the fact that like I didn't have money for a studio. I'm going to build it outside. And then I was like, oh, what if people knew I shot outside? Wouldn't that be kind of funny? So I did like one shot that was a little wider and one that was closer, but I had no idea that I was like coming up with something that people would resonate or that I would like. And yeah, to some degree, that concept was like post-rationalized. Like, I didn't initially go into the very first shoot being like, I'm going to play with perspective and show when you see the smaller piece of a larger picture how it can be misleading. As far as like ideating on projects now, a lot of times if I'm doing a commissioned like advertising job, there's some concept already there. And I think when I'm briefed well, whether it's an ad agency or a magazine, that allows me to do a better job of concepting, because I think when you're a creative and there's no guardrails, it's kind of like, what do we do? So you need to know, okay, like this is what we're trying to accomplish, and then within those confines, how do you do it? This weekend I'm doing a shoot with Sean from Acme, and I know I want to use this dude who has like a crazy beard, and Acme has a ton of taxidermy, so we're going to do like a taxidermy cabin wall. But then within there, it's like, well, what's an interesting play? Because it makes sense for that guy to be in the room, but like, what's something that doesn't make sense? So is he in a bathtub and playing with rubber duckies even though he has all this taxidermy? And it's like trying to find what's that clever twist on an idea so that it's not just taking a picture that looks like what would actually exist in real life. I don't consider myself a documentary photographer, so I want to create something that tells a story and has a twist to it.
What about when you're shooting like portraits? I mean, you've worked with so many interesting famous people. What is that like, and kind of how do you tell their story when you're just photographing them?
Light is like a very big part of how I shoot, and just the technical side of photography, and tying it back to investment banking. I think that the reason I gravitated towards photography versus any other art form is I think it's the most technical. You're not really creating something that doesn't exist. You're using things that exist and trying to make it the best version of that. I think that's why I like really gravitated towards photography. But when I'm shooting in studio, I like to use lighting to make my images stand out from other photographers. And then when you're shooting against a blank wall or whatever, a colored background, at the end of the day, it's the subject that's in front of the camera, that's going to tell the story. So you just try to figure out what is the best vehicle or method to do that. So whether that's a certain type of lighting or a type of background or a way that you're going to color grade it after, those are the things that go into my mind.
Yeah, I was just going to say, I mean, as Doobie and I were preparing for this and kind of looking at some of the people that you were able to shoot and work with, we were like, I wonder what they talk about as this is happening. Like, do you actually have conversations with people and do you prepare in that way too to create a relationship? Or is it something that's more like I have 5 minutes with them? These are the 7 things that I'm doing.
Usually it's like very limited time. Mm-hmm. And so I'll spend as much time as I can lighting it beforehand. So when they walk in, it's super quick.
Yeah.
But I also like to do a lot of research in advance to make sure that I know what to talk about and also what not to talk about. Mm-hmm. I have a friend who is a photo assistant and played Simon and Garfunkel on a Carrie Fisher set.
Oh, that's right.
And she's like, can you turn this off? So I think sometimes it's almost more so figuring out the guardrails of like, hey, what should you do versus not do?
Totally.
But then also trying to come up with things that you have in common with someone. And I did a shoot with Jeffrey Wright from Westworld.
Mm-hmm.
And I knew that he surfed. So I made sure that my surfboard was out in the studio. So it's a conversation starter. So trying to find subtle ways to like connect in a meaningful way. But when you have 5 minutes with someone, or I've had less than that, a lot of times it's just like trying to make them feel as comfortable as possible and trying not to make too much small talk. And let them, especially with celebrities, they have a few looks that they're going to give you and get those and see if there's anything else you can get out of them in the limited amount of time. But I've had shoots with people where you've had like really deep conversations as well. So it just depends how much time you have them for and just the energy on set and trying to feel out, do they want to talk? Do they not want to talk? A lot of times for actors, like getting their picture taken is not what they're looking forward to doing that day. They are doing 20 other press junkets. They've been asked the same 7 questions. And sometimes like they just want 3 minutes to chill in their head and do their thing. And if that's the case, then do that. If someone's giving you a lot of energy and wants to try a million different things, go for that. So I think a photographer, especially when shooting personalities, is just playing off the energy that's in the room and making sure that from me and then leading down from my assistants, even to catering, making sure that the energy is good and it's just a good vibe.
Yeah.
That's so interesting because photography as an art form, you have to vibe with your subjects, right? You're reacting to what's going on and you have a very limited amount of time versus if I'm painting, you know, I could take 10 years to create a painting and I could rip it up and do it over again. So how does your mind switch right when you have those 5 minutes, like compared to your normal day to day in terms of, you know,
like
thinking
turn
about,
on.
Yeah. How do you turn on? What's your mechanism?
I definitely like the like high intensity of a quick shoot. I'm very technical, so sometimes it's tough because I want to have a conversation with Daniel Radcliffe, but I'm also thinking that the light is 4 degrees off and I want to raise it up a little bit in power, and I didn't have the budget for a second assistant and the first one's over there, so I'm running around trying to make it work. So it's a tough balance, but I think it's just practicing. Like every shoot, I learn something new and I try to shoot as frequently as possible, if it's personal shoots or commissioned work, just to be practicing that at all times.
I love that. Yeah. One of the things that brings up for me, I was just kind of reflecting on your idea of using light. I really love in one of your latest projects how you've brought in another sense to stills, so using sound as well. So could you tell us a little bit about how you're thinking about different senses as you're shooting and then also about like throughout your other projects that you're working on?
Yeah, light's definitely like a big part of it, and that ties to visuals. For that project you're talking about, Scenes of New York, I wanted to figure how you could like immerse someone even more than just an image, and I have a hard time sometimes thinking about how motion would work, and it's also a lot more expensive to do motion, a lot more people on set. So I wanted to figure out how could I create a motionless movie where you have the audio and the feeling that you're really immersed there, but you just have a single image and you have to use your imagination to figure out what the movement is that's going on within there.
Yeah, I love that.
To me, it seems like you do such a great job of figuring out what you have and how do I make the best out of it. You know, I think that folks tend to forget how big you get or whatever it is. There's always some sort of constraint, right? And they're like, I'm not going to go ahead and shoot today because I don't have a DSLR. Once I can afford that, then I'll start practicing.
So as I'm thinking about like your future, you tend to always have a lot of different projects going on. What are you thinking about in terms of what's inspiring you going forward and like what's on your mind in the next couple of months?
I'm definitely enjoying these big set collaborations with mm-hmm. Sean because mm-hmm. I feel like a kid in a candy shop where mm-hmm. there's like literally everything that you can think of. I did a shoot with him recently where I was like, can we get a taxidermy bear? He's like, 1 second, coming in, taxidermy bear. And then I'm like, can I get boxing gloves so this kid can look like he's fighting a taxidermy bear? He's like, coming up. And I was like, all right, let's get both of those out there. I want this kid to be playing a trumpet in like a fancy artist hallway or whatever. Yeah. And yeah. it's like the only place in the world I can ask for a trumpet, boxing gloves yeah. for a kid and a taxidermy bear and that's get all of them. So I think that's pretty awesome.
Yeah.
I've been working on a project on Hasidic men for the past like year and a half. Mm. So, that I don't know if it's coming to a close or at least maybe I'll be ready to release some of the work in progress, but I've shot over 30 men so far.
Wow.
And most of the work that I've seen of the Hasidic community is much more voyeuristic and documentary. Mm. And there's not really that sense of permission to mm-hmm. have the photo taken, but I've been doing studio portraits with them, shooting wow. them like I would, celebrity or any other subject that comes into the studio where there is that sense of consent.
What is the background on that if you want to share?
I grew up in San Francisco area as like a Reformed Jew, and then I moved to Williamsburg and saw a lot of Hasidic Jews and thought, wow, this is almost a different religion just from yeah. the outside from what I grew up with. And so I wanted to learn more about that, and the way that I learn about things is through photography. And so I thought it would be interesting to do a project that I invited them into my studio and spent time and kind of discussing the similarities and differences of how we grew up and how they live now. And trying to do it in a different way that wasn't like documentary style, but brought them out of that world and into the studio where I could really elevate and capture their characteristics.
Mm. Yeah, that's so interesting.
Super interesting. It's really something I was thinking about, and it kind of brings it up as you said, your way of learning about a topic is by photography. For me, it's like the way I process things is through writing. Mm-hmm. And a lot of times when we read someone's perspective on something, we're seeing exactly that how that person thought of it. And we don't necessarily create our own version of it. But with photography, it's so much of it is left up to the other person's interpretation. So when you think about, this is kind of going back to storytelling, but when you think about like what message you want to share, how do you kind of get that across, or do you kind of leave it up to interpretation by the viewer, essentially?
I like to leave it up to interpretation, because I think even if you try to clearly communicate something, mm-hmm. sometimes it gets lost in translation. So I like to leave a lot of my images pretty open-ended. I feel like a lot photography is similar to a joke where if you have to describe it too much and write a 2-paragraph yeah. essay on what you're shooting, mm-hmm. then it's probably not very good, and there's exceptions to that rule, but yeah. I like my work to be accessible where someone can look at it and derive some meaning, whether that's what I was going after or how they take it, that doesn't matter. But yeah. I like to make it as accessible as possible.
Yeah, that's really cool.
Yeah, no, I was gonna say, I think it's also a stark contrast of what folks are used to seeing now when photography is so democratized and everyone can take a picture. There, people are just taking pictures of themselves doing things. So I'm interested in hearing your perspective on like how photography has changed over the last few years, and then also adding in, you know, with scenes in New York City, you add another element about the senses. I take a skeptic view of this, more of like you're creating this because the attention span is so like short now that you need to like make everything so immersive. That's the rise of virtual reality. But I want to hear your, you know, intention be on both of these sort of areas.
Yeah, the music or the audio portion of Scenes of New York was for that reason. I was thinking, okay, I'm going to have a gallery show. How do I make sure that people look at it and consume it for more than 10 seconds? How do you make someone listen for a minute and a half? Mm-hmm. And it was interesting to see when I did do a show, like it's hard for people to listen to 7 stories for a minute and a half each. Like asking for 12 minutes of someone's time is a lot in today's day and age. So that was an interesting learning for me.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And your previous question was?
Yeah, more so how photography has changed. I think because it's so like democratized, everyone can take it. I think we went back to my parents' house and we were looking at photos that are in a photo album and the different emotion that's there versus the emotion that's created on Instagram versus your photography. Like, what's your view on all of those?
I feel like I've benefited from the democratization of photography. Like, I've never shot much film. Mm-hmm. I went straight to shooting digital. The cost of doing a shoot that looks highly produced can be quite affordable now. Lighting equipment's gotten a lot cheaper too. I think the reason my photography stands out to some degree is because I'm doing like constructed reality where it's these scenes that are hyper real and wouldn't naturally exist. So I think being a lifestyle photographer, which is shooting people smiling, having fun in the sun, drinking Coca-Cola, is a tougher field to compete in because I think there's a lot of people who are able to do that and some people can't do it well. And I think that's a lot more of drawing the emotion out of a subject. But my work is very technical. There's a lot of lighting, a lot of set design, and there's just a lot that goes into running a set when there's 30 to 50 people on set. So I think that's one way I've been able to differentiate myself, that there's a lot less people who play in that world because it's not so easy to do. It takes a long time. It's different than just pulling out your phone and taking a picture. So
And it's cool. I think going back to what Katina said, it allows like the viewer to just have their own imagination take a play, and you lose that in, I think, in some lifestyle photography. You know, you're looking at something for 5 seconds and you move on to the next.
Totally. Yeah. I mean, my goal is when you look at an image of mine that you kind of discover something new every time you see it. And that, it's hard now living on Instagram because some of these images are so small. If I had my way, all my pictures would be blown up five feet wide and you'd really get to see each little thing.
I love that. I definitely agree. I feel like I've been looking at your work kind of as we've been thinking about this conversation, and every time I go back to it, I'm like, wow, I didn't notice that before, or it kind of makes me think about it differently. So I have definitely been a beneficiary of that.
Well, thank you.
Okay, cool. So as we kind of wrap up each conversation, we love to ask two questions that are really important to us. So the first one is all about this concept of being unproductive. And obviously it sounds like you don't, you kind of are always thinking about photography and creativity, but we find that some of our most brilliant moments come from moments when we're most unproductive and relaxed. So what are things that you do in your free time to kind of keep you inspired and excited?
I think long showers are pretty awesome. You can't have your phone.
Yeah.
I think that I'm not the only person to say that, but
actually we were, when we were sharing Daydreamers, like when it was just a small concept with someone in San Francisco, they were like, maybe you should just have a space where people could take long showers.
Yeah.
We were like, showers are sick. Down. Hot tubs, sick. Yeah. Not so easy to find in New York.
Yeah.
Yeah. If I'm ever like rich, or not even rich, but enough to spend 10 grand and I won't think about it, definitely doing a hot tub. Big fan of that. But I like to surf a lot. That's another situation where you like don't have a phone on you. I'm like definitely addicted to that little rectangle, so
I know
it's nice to be in a situation where I'm not doing that. I like playing board games. I don't think I'm like super creative necessarily when I do that, but it's just like a social outlet. 90% of my time as a photographer, you spend alone doing emails and marketing and retouching and all the unsexy side of it all. So I like having friends over for board games. I like to try to exercise every day. So that's usually running, but sometimes it's biking, or I've started playing tennis very casually. Just trying to do something to, I feel like if I'm in a bad mood, generally it's a combination, or I've been eating trash, or I haven't exercised. So just scientifically, if you like study your body's chemistry, like if you can at least do both of those, hopefully you won't be feeling too awful. Totally. And then sleeping well too. I definitely sleep like 8 hours a night.
Yeah.
That's awesome.
So does Stoofy.
Yeah. That's why I don't have any bags anymore.
Yeah. Catching up for all the hours of avoidance.
Exactly.
Stoofy wakes up at 10 and he's like, whatever. I didn't sleep for years.
I'm the same way. Yeah. I sleep also like very, I'm a big napper too. Yesterday at like 3 o'clock, I'm like, sounds like nap o'clock to me.
That's great.
I love that.
Yeah, I think we don't like place enough value on sleeping too.
Totally.
I think if you think about how productive we are as humans, like getting an extra like 3% or 10% of productivity by sleeping an extra hour, so worth it.
Yeah. And I think it's also goes back to this whole hustle culture where like we pride ourselves on not sleeping. Mm-hmm. I think that the tides are changing a little bit, but I totally agree. I'm an 8 hour night sleeper too, and it makes such a difference in my day.
I also read something that you had said that dreams often inspire your creative perspective or like what you're shooting. So, you know, I think it's interesting that you do nap and, and you're taking it makes a difference, you know, so.
Definitely.
So, yeah, the final question we love to ask people, and I think you were hitting on this before, is like, when were you the most creative as a child and how you can bring out that inner child to be like naive and just go for it? Like, what's your advice for people to do that now, or how can they channel that?
Yeah, I think trying to set the stakes to be low is the best way to be creative, because then it doesn't matter. And also trying to remind you, for me, I'm like so logic based that I'll start concepting and be like, well, that's not possible. This isn't possible. And even if that's true, sometimes those spark new ideas. So it's good to just write that down to see like what it leads to. But on the like subject of child creativity, I was over 4th of July with my girlfriend's family and whatever, nieces and nephews. And there's like a few like 5 or 6 year old kids, and it was funny to show them my photographs and ask them to explain me what's going on.
Yeah,
like, why is there a pig in this fancy lady's apartment?
Yeah,
and there's money on the floor and she's drinking, like, you know. So I think that's a fun exercise too, is having kids reinterpret your images. So
That's awesome. I love that.
Something I've been wanting to do is just like have two sets of white rooms, one with adults and one with kids, and see like have a problem that has no answers, no right answers. And my hypothesis is that the kids will come up with like 100 different solutions and the adults will come up with like 10.
Totally. Yeah.
Yeah. Of course. We talk ourselves out of everything.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's interesting, because I think when you're younger, you're like more creative, but don't know what's or how to tackle a problem. And I think the older you get, the more limited your mind is, but you're also able to execute on those things much quicker. So it's all about finding that balance.
Totally.
But I think being able to execute and being logic based is also important, because you can dream on ideas for forever, but at the end of the day, I think a lot of my ideas suck, but you just keep executing on them, and eventually you do one like set in the street and people resonate with it, and that's cool, but you just got to keep going. And
I love that.
Do more. Just do more. Iterate, and just what feels great, you know.
Yeah.
Well, awesome.
Well, thank you so much for being on Unproductive. We're so grateful for you, and we're excited to kind of stay updated and see what's next.
Thank you. Yeah, stoked for you guys.
Yeah, awesome.
Hey everyone, and thanks for tuning into our chat with Justin Bettman.
So cool.
Yeah, I thought it was really amazing how relatable he is on his journey. You know, he's continuing to garner more success and learn more things. And, you know, he's not that much of an age difference between Katina and I.
Yeah.
And I think that's so important when you're listening into some of these conversations. Some people are on the grind with you.
Yeah.
And some people, you know, have hindsight as 2020, you know, they've done it there. And it's amazing to learn from their accolades and take inspiration from their life.
Totally.
So what was your favorite part?
It was definitely his ability to just do stuff. I feel like a lot of times, you know, as we get older, we get so caught up in the rules. And I feel like especially after hearing Elle's podcast a few weeks ago, there's so much in creativity that's really just about getting outside of your own head and the stuff that you make up that you kind of have to fit this mold. Even Craig's when he talks about coloring mm-hmm. outside of the lines. So
a nonconformist.
Yeah, exactly. So I feel like Justin's was such a relatable way to be like, oh yeah, why am I telling myself that I like, you know, need a mm-hmm. perfect set or these permits? I could just kind of do it and see what happens.
Yeah, and if you didn't know, Katina was huge into punk rock during her high school phase.
No, I wasn't.
One of the best parts for me of this podcast was his perspective. You know, I think oftentimes we believe that someone is doing something with such great intention. Mm. And I'm that person where I need to have plan A through plan F. Yeah. And I don't go ahead with anything until I have all of those. But his set on the street was literally like, I don't have tools and equipments to create something beautiful, but I'm going to take what I have mm-hmm. and then also take a separate lens like that steps back and showcases the fact that this is a set in the middle of the street, you know, and that was pretty epic.
Yeah.
But he never thought of it that way. You know, it just kind of transpired into something so, so big. And I think that's really important for me to realize and learn mm-hmm. and hopefully others, is like sometimes you just got to do more and you got to see what happens and don't be scared.
Yeah, exactly. I think that's a common theme throughout all of the interviews, but this mm-hmm. one especially.
Yep.
Cool. So next week we'll be chatting with Liz Plank. It's such a fun conversation. Mm-hmm. She is a researcher, journalist, political extraordinaire, and author of her latest book, For the Love of Men. Don't let all those kind of titles fool you, though. Liz is so down to earth and really fun. And our chat is super interesting because it's kind of dually focused, both on Liz's own experience of tapping into her creativity after following a more traditional academic route, but also we dive into her research about creativity when it comes to these long-held gender stereotypes, mm-hmm. Which I think was really interesting for both Dupi and I to be kind of involved in that conversation. Right. So you definitely don't want to miss this episode. It's not only really timely with everything that's going on in our world, but I think it has so much power to shift our perception of what we're allowed to do versus not, kind of tying it back to Justin's mm-hmm. punk rock view of the world.
Until our next episode, please don't forget to rate and review us on Apple Podcasts. This helps more people find the podcast and get inspired to live creative lives and get cool, interesting guests to share their stories with y'all. Until then, keep creating and show us how you're being a leisurist by tagging us on Instagram @daydreamerspace.
Till next time.